Shalom Chaver, Binyamin Hammer here at National Council Young Israel. We welcome all the Rabbanim for conference call number 58. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Question number one, guidelines about the halachas of body piercings for women, other than earrings in the earlobe and nose rings, nezem. Is a woman allowed to pierce any other part of the body? How about rings in the upper part of the ear and the cartilage? Is she permitted to pierce a part of the body that only her husband will see? Could these halachas be different for single women and married women? Very difficult to find any written sources on this topic. Thanks to Rabbi Shapiro in our library, he found the Shelos Tshuvos Vishav Varafa, Rabbi Eifert from Amsterdam, who discusses this issue from two perspectives. One is the Easter of Chavolah, unnecessary wounding of oneself, which is a very major question in the Poskim, the Minchas Chinuch, and the Shulchan Aruch HaRav talk about it, not an open and shut issue. He makes a reference to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach being lenient. It's well known that Moray Rabbi Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, wanted to prohibit his daughter from piercing her ears on the grounds of unnecessary chavala. And she would not accept his ruling. And he said, okay, we'll go to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman. The story is told they went to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, who, as soon as they walked in, gave her a very big smile and was talking to her and ignoring her father. And when it came to the question of piercing the ears, he said, well, in my family, there's a very long-standing custom that girls pierce their ears before they turn bat mitzvah. There's no problem. What happened to the Easter of Chavala? Apparently he held that the Chavala is so small, relatively speaking, and it's done for the sake of beauty, of noy, of having pierced ears to put in the earrings, that it would be permissible. Now, beauty is in the eyes of the either the beholder of piercings or the woman who does the piercings. If she considers it to be beautiful, then it's difficult to answer it on the grounds of chavala, assuming that the wound is negligible, not a significant probability of infection. Every case and every piercing is different, but suffice to say, it's one cannot make a blanket prohibition on the grounds of chavala unless you want to ask the piercing their ears, which Rav Lichtenstein, that's how I wanted to do, but apparently it's not accepted by the Rav Poskim. So what else is the problem? He suggests chukos akum. This is something which comes from the non-Jewish world, and it doesn't make much sense. So therefore, maybe it's prohibited. Now, of course, if one considers it beautiful, then it does make sense from that perspective. Again, beauty is very subjective. In short, it's difficult to make a blanket prohibition. Look, at the same time, strongly discourage such behavior, which I certainly would do. Not everything that is permissible is ruach hachamim nocha himenu. Seems to me this is a new style. Obviously, this never happened in years gone by in our parts of the world, and it shouldn't be done. But the fact that it shouldn't be done does not make it an absolute prohibition. So every Rav has to, use his discretion in how to deal with individuals who come with this question. I should make a distinction, not between whether it's visible to others besides the husband or not. That makes no difference. But it is a problem of chatzitza. Very serious problem. Earrings, it's well known that they should be removed before tevilah. And I believe women always have done so. Some of these other nose rings, etc. So I've heard in the mikvah they quote A, B, and C said, I don't have to remove them. Apparently it's more of a hassle to remove them. I'll only make one brief source. If you look in Rabbi Forrest's beautiful Sefer, Volume 2 in Hilchos Nida, page 303, is a lengthy discussion of earrings. Possible distinction between tight earrings and loose earrings, lichatchila b'di'evet, very, very thorny issue, which is Tom is not allowed to go into in detail. Suffice it to say that certainly the chatchila, these hears things which have rings in them would be a chatzitza question, according to some even b'di'evet, and therefore they should certainly be discouraged if they're not going to be removed when the woman needs to go to the mikvah. Question two. If someone donates money to a shul for a specific purpose or a special item to be used by the shul, and the shul is not using the item at all, or the money for the purpose for which it was donated was not purchased, can the donor ask for the return of the money or item? Closest precedent is Simon Yoredeya, Simon Reish Nun Gimel, Sif Zion. They collected money for Pidyon Shvuyim to redeem someone who was in jail, and the person passed away, so you can't redeem him anymore. There are two opinions. We paskin that the heirs of the deceased do not get the money, wasn't for them, and because he didn't give the money on that basis. You only get the money for one purpose, and the purpose can no longer be satisfied. So the poskim say, Beis Yosef there, im efshar, if it's possible, you give him back to the donator. What does the donator do with the money? It doesn't say explicitly, but there's a dispute. In the Oros Zeruah Siman Zayin, some say that the donator should use the money for a similar mitzvah or a greater mitzvah. And I quote, Hol ulashay mitzvah hifrishum ulchvot shamayim eino rashor le'akav v'yatzvah. Since he originally donated it for a purpose of a mitzvah, l'shem kovot shamayim, it's not right he should put the money into his own general bank account. Some disagree. But in any event, the donator can ask for the money in return, and it should be returned to him if possible, and he'll decide, perhaps in consultation with the Rav, whether he should be machmir for the opinion in the Oros Zeruah that he should use it for a mitzvah similar or greater, or he can just put into his general bank account. Question three. Shabbos scooter on Shabbos and Yom Tov. If a person has a heter to use a Shabbos scooter, if there's a shul closer to his home that he can walk to with great difficulty, or use a scooter to get there, is he still permitted to use a scooter to attend the shul further away? He's always a member of that more distant shul and he feels most comfortable there. Well, the Shabbos scooter in principle is no different than the Somet wheelchair, which works through the principle of Grama, based on Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Arbach Psak. There's another version, Machon Technologi, that works in Rav Halperin's guidance. However, neither of these leniencies is universally accepted. It's very possible, according to my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, it would not be considered to be a grama, and therefore there would be a prohibition. Therefore, always preferred to avoid these devices on Shabbos, if possible. If someone is in a wheelchair, the best thing is that another individual should be asked to do a chesed and use a regular wheelchair, not a motorized wheelchair. Maybe some equivalent when it comes to scooters as well. Shas hatzchak gadol, in a situation of great difficulty, of course one can rely on the psaka attributed to Rabbi Shlomo Zalman. I once mentioned that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman is quoted as saying, well, I didn't find it in print, that even if it would be a rabbinic prohibition, perhaps there's room to be lenient based on kavod abrius, because independence is certainly a very basic ingredient of human dignity. It seems to me, in this particular case, it's up to the Rav who's asked the question to determine whether going to the far shul, which is a shul which is preferred by this individual, is that itself considered a shas hatzchak gadol? Maybe the person could go to that shul during the week, and on Shabbos he can go to the closest shul and still maintain his connection to his former congregation. But to avoid having to rely on this doubtful leniency, can go to shul on Shabbos closer to his home. That's the Rav's discretion. Question number four. I've noticed the article Siddur from Igros Moshe Orach Chaim Siman 70. The proper time to say Brich Shmei is when the Sefer Torah is being taken out. It seems that most shuls say it before. What are the other sources? Okay. This is an interesting question. I looked up the Dirshu. Siman Kuf Lamed Dalet, Mishnah Berurah Sifkad Yud Gimel, footnote 14, says that the Mount Ephraim there in Sefer Rosh Hashanah and in Shaar Ephraim is the same with the whole back of Barsha. Others disagree and say that it should begin when they when the Sefer Torah is in the Aron Kodesh, but it should complete it later on. And some say you should say it totally when the Sefer Torah is in the Aron Kodesh, which is those two customs are more prevalent nowadays against Rav Moshe. They have sources. It seems to me that we shouldn't make a big deal about it because there's no obligation to say Brich Shmei in the first place. If you look in the Nusach Ashkenaz original Siddurim, the Yekah Siddurim, it's not there. So we shouldn't spend too much time arguing about when it should be said, if it's going to be said at all. Every person should do what he has made against without being upset if someone else does different. Question 5. What are the guidelines for using a food warmer on Shabbos? It seems to be one approach that's all food in before Shabbos and just one opening on Shabbos morning or Friday night for that matter. Can a Jew open and close the warmer? Is it possible to allow food to be put in Shabbos morning or Friday night after the Friday night meal? Our shul is looking to buy a warmer. Are there any special considerations? Very important question. The opinion which maintains that is what they call the approach, one opening on Shabbos morning, views it as follows. They say that when you open the warmer, since most of these warmers have a thermostat, what's going to happen is that the fire will either increase right then and there, or if not, as is more likely, will increase earlier than otherwise. And making a fire go on earlier than otherwise could be a serious halachic problem. That's why they said you open it once. It's true that opening itself may yield the same result of it going on earlier than otherwise, but if you take all the food out before during that one opening and then close the oven, or don't close the oven as the case may be, and it goes on earlier, that's what's called a psikresha de lo nichole. You couldn't care less because there's nothing in the oven from that point on. However, if you put something, only take half of the stuff out of the oven, then it's a psikresha de nichole. That's the rationale, as I understand it, of this approach. It seems to me that the halacha is not that way, that we permit such an action, well, called a delayed psikresha, even in a case of nichale. Even if you want the a result that's going to ensue, that the fire will go on later to heat the food. If one denies this premise, then it's hard to understand how is a person allowed to open up the door to his house in weather like today, it's freezing. You open the door to your house, a gust of cold air will come in. It will undoubtedly lead to the central heating, which is not a thermostat, go on earlier than otherwise, and that's nichole. In a more reduced form, the same thing is true of a refrigerator. It's customary in most places to open the refrigerator on Shabbos when the motor is idle, even though you know as a result hot air will come in and the machine will go on earlier, the compressor, than otherwise. How is that possible? So presumably we rely on this, on the Svarah of the Shulta Giborim in the Masechta Shabbos and the Sugah Daf Kuf Chaf Mevei, the Sugah of Grama, that says that if the psik resha and it happens later on, it's permissible even in a circumstance where the result is nichole. If that's the case, it should be permissible to have half the food taken out now and half the food remaining behind. Frankly, if that would be not allowed, it's hard to allow it at all, because the Shulchan Aruch Paschal's situation is lo nichole, is prohibited. So it's not so simple to make the distinction that's being made by this approach, even though I'm told that very distinguished Rabbanim have advocated that approach. That's as far as opening and taking things out of the warmer. As far as putting things into the warmer, much greater problem. There is an Issa called Hanocha Mitzchila. Take something from a refrigerator or something which is lying on a table, according to most authorities, and put it back into an oven, is a question of hanacha mitchila. Now, there can be two reasons for this prohibition. One is, shema yachata b'gacholim, you may adjust the fire. And two is nirekim levashel, it looks like cooking. Now, obviously, both issues have to be contended with in this case. So as far as shem yechata b'gacholim, it depends on whether it's adjustable or non-adjustable. If you're buying a warmer, perhaps you're best over the non-adjustable warmer to avoid this issue. If you cannot buy a non-adjustable warmer, you already have one which is adjustable, it's difficult to overcome the issue of shem yechata b'gacholim. We sometimes overcome it, at least in part, using something called a blech. A blech is something which is covering a fire in a manner that's clearly recognizable and noticeable to someone who approaches the fire to remind him not to adjust the fire. In most of the warmers that we have, that's an impossibility because the adjustment is towards the outside, and the covering of the fire, if you would want to do so, would be on the inside. You get to the point of adjustment before you can even see the so-called blech that you may put in terms of tinfoil or the like under the trays which have the hot food. There is a heter called tachbitit, which was used by the ovens in Europe. It would take plaster on the opening to the oven, and this would be a very, very significant impediment to getting the food out and stoking the coals, because you have to break through the plaster. And this is enough of a reminder not to stoke the coals, not to increase the fire. How do you do that when it comes to our situation? Assuming there's an adjustment on the outside. So in my opinion, you have to cover it in a fashion that make it difficult to remove that covering in short order, and would serve as a sufficient reminder. The Sefer Orchel Shabbos, he contends that even one piece of tape might be sufficient to be the equivalent of tach petit. In my view, it's not enough. It comes off too easily. Find a series of pieces of tape or other items with which to cover up the knob, so that it should be difficult to remove them and difficult to adjust the fire. That might be a heter which would allow tach petit. Although the Chazon Ish limits this dispensation of tach petit to what we call shehia, that means putting on the fire before Shabbos, it's possible that the only reason why he's strict when it's done after Shabbos would not apply in situations such as ours, where there's no consideration of nirekim mevashel, because you don't normally cook on it. That's a possibility. If it's not adjustable, then I believe the nirekim mevashel does not apply, because no one cooks in these warmers, and then it would be permissible to put the food back on Shabbos. Question number 6. A woman is having a hysterectomy due to cancer. Regarding NIDA status, is there any difference if it was done vaginally or laparoscopically? Is it going to be verified that the entire uterus was removed? Can she do a hefsek on day 5, even if there is dam? Because it is certainly damaka, not nida. Do we trust doctors telling us it was all removed? The reality, after speaking to an OBGYN, is that there's no real difference whether it's laparoscopic or not, because detached laparoscopically is removed vaginally. So in any event, it's going to be a problem. It seems to me that the status of nida does exist because of there is some dam nida which could easily be coming out vaginally, and therefore I believe she should wait until she is clean and then do a hefsek tara. Remember, this is it. This is the final hefsek tara of a lifetime. So if she has to wait an extra few days until things clear out, it's kedai, even though one could make an argument, a few arguments, why it's not really necessary. But since given these circumstances, the proper thing to do is to wait till she's clean, do a Haftara, count 7 clean days, and go to the mikvah for a final time in her life. Question 7. In the field of mediation, is there anything wrong with facilitating between two Jews, knowing that a great deal of the consideration is that they would be going to secular court if the mediation doesn't work, and therefore the decisions are highly influenced by our calls? In divorce mediation, are there considerations to pay attention to so that the guest should not be compromised as being of his own free will? I believe that the word decision is incorrect. If it's mediation, there are no decisions. Mediators don't make final decisions. They make recommendations, which can be accepted or rejected by the parties. And therefore, there cannot be any prohibition of what we'll call our calls, because there's no decisions. Even though the recommendation may be influenced by what courts would say, there's no prohibition since no decisions are being made. For the same reason, it's obvious to me that any get given after a recommendation of a mediator is 100% kosher. There's no judge making any decisions, compelling anything, and therefore I think it would be okay. Question 8. A colleague told me he's going on vacation to a location which is more than 18 minutes away from the shul, so he'll have no issue with tefillah b'tzibur, and he can relax and get away, really get away and relax. This strikes me as improper. What's my opinion about this? What about going on a business trip where there's no minyan? Now, the 18 minutes is true. A person should travel up to 18 minutes to find a minyan, but this fellow is going to go 19 minutes away from the closest shul to somehow absolve himself of that obligation. That certainly strikes me as improper, trying to get out of something. At the same time, it's important to understand that as critical as tefillah b'tzibur is, and in Shulchan Aruch it's found repeatedly the importance of tefillah b'tzibur, how a person should make sure to go to shul in his community, how tefillah b'tzibur is much more accepted than tefillah b'yachid. At the same time, one cannot characterize tefillah b'tzibur as an absolute obligation. Some of you may know that in certain brisker circles, they're very not into tefillah b'tzibur. They often daven b'yichidus. We don't think that's proper at all, but just giving you a reality check. Some circles, they're not so careful about tefillah b'tzibur. I should make a comment, just in passing, that in community in which I reside, tefillah b'tzibur has experienced an incredible upsurge in the last two generations. Used to be many shuls who have very difficult time getting a minyan together during the week, even though there are hundreds and hundreds of people there on Shabbos. In most communities today, it's no longer the fact. It's no longer the case. You go to some of these big shuls and some of the nice Jewish communities, and they're packed during the week. All kinds of minyanim, all the vesikin, and many shachas, and mincha, and marav till late at night, which is something which did not exist in this part of the community two generations ago. So that's a blessed phenomenon. We're very wonderful, see, an aksha dara. But in any event, it's not an absolute chiyuv. You should try very hard to daven with a minyan, unless there's a counter consideration which is more important. I would say that making a living, business trip, it is more important. A person needs to make a living, or even what we'll call a better living, in order to support his family properly. It would be permissible to go on a business trip, even though he cannot have with a minyan for as long as he's on that trip, which is a pretty common occurrence in certain people's business dealings. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the first part of the question, which is discussing a vacation, we can really get away and relax, as if you can't relax at home. You only really relax when you get away. I reject that assumption. Don't think it's true in reality. There may be people who, in order to relax, they have to really relax and get away, go far, far away, really far away. No. And there are plenty of getaway places which have minyanim. No, he has to go really far away where there's nobody there. Not another non-Jews. If those are the circumstances that he cannot relax and get a vacation otherwise, then there's room to be lenient. But I would encourage him to reconsider and find either relax near home, or if you're looking for a vacation spot, there are plenty of advertisements for vacation spots which have minyanim and kosher food and all the services, which I'm told are very beautiful. Perhaps this individual can reconsider and can, quote, really get away and relax, even in such a setting. Question number 9. If someone with a chiyuv comes to shul after a chasna has already started davening for the yomot, at what point can the chiyuv take over? Shachris, mincha, and maariv. Well, you know, in some shuls, the chasna doesn't even go up to the yomot until yishtabach. The Rambam says that tefillah b'sibah starts there. Everything until there is tefillah b'sibah. In other shuls, the chasna stands there but doesn't say the last sentence of each paragraph out loud until a certain designated time. There's a bang on the table, and they say yishtabach. Seems to be obvious that if a person walks in before that and is ready to assume the yomot at yishtabach, there's nothing wrong with that. It's done in many other circumstances where there is no chiyuv, just like that, for no other reason. So that's certainly okay. In other shuls, in Shachris, there's a switch right before the Ashrei, towards the end of davening, for a whole variety of reasons. Maybe the chazan is tired, or there's someone else wants to take over, for whatever reason. Often it's done in the case where there are two chiyuvim, or your ten and a chiyuv, things of this nature. But it's clearly an established custom that another person takes over before the Ashrei after Chazaras Hashat. In such a circumstance, if it's known in advance by the Baal Chazaras Hashat that he's stepping aside before Ashrei, it seems to me that the proper custom is, in that case, for the chazan to take 3 steps back after he finishes Sim Shalom and Yule Ratzon. Normally he does not, because he's relying on the 3 steps he's going to take back in Kaddish Niskabel after Uval Tzion. But since he's not doing that, he will be replaced. It's proper to take the 3 steps back at that stage right away after the Chazaras Hashat has concluded. This is as far as the obvious things to me. What about, this happened in my shtibul, where someone else would take over at Chazaras Hashat? How did that happen? It was very simple. The Balabatim davened very fast. And the rabbi davened slow. He didn't want to be in that situation where they're going too fast. So he would daven for the yomot. On the other hand, he couldn't daven fast enough to make them happy for Chazaras Hashat. So on a daily basis, someone else take over Chazaras Hashat, who daven very quickly. So there is, at least in my experience, a precedent for that. Someone taking over at Chazaras Hashat. And I guess in certain circumstances, it can be done. I don't see any prohibition. In the case that we're discussing of the chiyuv, if he could take over Chazaras Hashat, not only is he davening for the yom of Chazaras Hashat, which is self-important, but he also would say the Chatzi Kaddish after Tachnun, which he would not say if he first took over just before Ashrei. So I know at least there's a precedent in some circumstances to allow even that. As far as Mincha, again, he walks in the middle of Ashrei. It's no problem for him to just say Tilas Hashem Edabepi and take over at the say the Chatzi Kaddish, even though somebody else had already got up there to say Ashrei and was halfway through. That would not be a problem. So that's a very common case. If you got a few seconds late for Mincha, that would be no problem. Again, according to the precedent that I cited, it would even be permissible if them came in later than that. Let's say they just started Shemona Esrei, he should go over to the guy and say, if you don't mind, I'll take over Chazaras Hashat. That might be a possibility as well. As far as Maariv is concerned, he starts right away with Baruch Hu. So obviously, if he comes before that, he can take over. But if he comes after that, so then it's a problem. Perhaps he can take over at the end of the Birchot Krishma after the last bracha. And instead of the original guy who's been there until now, he should say the Chatzi Kaddish and then the Kaddish Niskabel after Shemona Esrei. Possible. So the best thing for a chiyuv is to try to come on time. Question number 10. The shul without a rav. The shul has 80 cup hot water urn with a Shabbos switch. The switch maintains the cooked water at around 190 degrees Fahrenheit. The switch was not turned on before Shabbos. One congregant who went down to the kitchen right before Shabbos saw the urn's water was cooked and steam was coming out. Shabbos morning, because the switch was off, the water was not hot, and people had tepid, hot, warm coffee. The manual does not say what the temperature will fluctuate to when the Shabbos switch is not activated. Lo and behold, after davening, the thermostat kicked in, and the water was hot again for coffee and tea. We did not use the urn at the Kiddush, but could we have? That's an excellent question. It could happen again. Seems to me, if the thermostat works by itself in some manner, which we can't fully predict, apparently, there would be no violation of Bishul. It happened by itself. I'm assuming that nobody tampered with it. If someone tampered with it, it's a whole different story. But if it happened by itself, then there's no issue of Bishul, and therefore that issue is resolved. As we said before, there is another issue called issue of Shehiyah. If something is left on a fire before Shabbos, or is in a situation such as that on Shabbos called Hakzara, this could be a problem of Shem Yechata Begacholim, that perhaps the person would adjust the fire. From what I understand, as a general rule, most urns have no adjustment. They're either on or off. You can't make it hotter or colder, and therefore that prohibition would not exist. There's no issue of Bishul, and there's no issue of Shehiya or Achzara because of Shem Yechata, because Chitui is impossible. Then it seems to me it would be Mutter, Amikra Din. There's a whole discussion comes up in somewhat similar circumstance, not identical, where there were certain power outages when it would go on later on. This seems to be even a little bit better because apparently no human intervention caused the heating element to go on again. It was just one of the vagaries of the system without a benefit of the thermostat. If that is the question, then I think the answer is that it's okay. 11. Regarding Hilchos Yichud, case, Reuven, a single man, has a female tenant who has a separate entrance to the basement apartment, but there is some shared space, the steps down to the basement. Is there any problem of Yichud if she is in her apartment? This tenant also cleans the house of Reuven and is able to come and go whenever she wants to wash dishes or to clean, etc. Is there any heter if the front door is left open or unlocked? What if it is late at night? This man has a daughter who lives in his house as well. Does this alleviate any potential issue? It's a lengthy question. It seems to me, at first glance, that just the first three lines of the question, there's no problem whatsoever because they're two separate apartments, and we'll call it a hallway in between. It's like we have in my building where I live. There are different apartments. A hallway in between, and it could be a man in one apartment, a woman in another apartment. We never heard there should be an Easter Yichud in such a circumstance. Two separate apartments in an apartment house. That's assumed to be permissible. If this is similar, it would be okay. If I understand correctly, there's a kind of a hall, right? Steps down to the basement. Then you can go into one house and lock the door, and go into the other house and lock the door, and the two have nothing to do with each other. So it's true that the steps to the basement, they're named not as spacious as the hallway on my floor to get from one apartment to another. But I don't think that matters as long as you have to go through that hall to get from one to the other, and that hall is, in effect, exposed to the world. Anyone can walk in there. There's no lock on the outside of that hall, which I'm assuming. Then from a strict perspective, there can be no Yisra of Yichud. Just as in an apartment house, there's no Yisra of Yichud. That's as far as the first part of the question is concerned. For her to go into his apartment when he is there? Absolutely not. Not allowed. That's an Isser of Yichud. And one cannot rely, in my opinion, on the fact that the front door is either open or unlocked. Because people are not going to go into his private apartment, even if they walk into the little stairway between the two apartments. So the front door, to my mind, won't help at all. If it meant that the front door to the apartment itself is left open, that's what it means. I wouldn't call that the front door. I'd call it the door of the apartment. Then, if it's wide open and people are walking by, and the person isn't, visible from the opening, that would be a good leniency. But once you move around in the apartment out of the range of vision, not so simple. Not clear people are going to go actually walk in and say hello and look to every remote corner of the apartment, even if the door happens to be open. Of course, if his daughter is there, that solves the entire problem. Because of Bito Misham Rosso, the poskim say, not everyone agrees to this, but most poskim say that not only do we say that if his wife is with him, that's a shmir, but even if any other woman with whom he's not suspected of doing anything wrong, because there's no yetzer d'arayis, such circumstance, as the Chazal cut out that yetzer for sexual relations, so then that individual not only may have yichud with her father, which is done on a daily basis, that's for sure, okay, but she would also serve as a protection against yichud with the father, between her father and some other woman. You understand that the Gemara prohibited yichud between a man and two women because chas v'shalom he could sin with both. But if one he won't sin with, then he'd be embarrassed to sin with the other. So that would be a hefty if the daughter actually is in the house with the father. Final question, number 12. I have a sliding door going from outside the house to a sunroom. The mezuzah should be on the outside going into the house, but there is no doorpost on the outside. The sliding door is flush with the wall of the house. Should the mezuzah be put on the inside? If so, on the right or left side? Or should it be put on the outside wall of the house? It seems to me, there's a middle view. And the middle view is that sliding door, which I assume, again, the way I'm reading the question, the sliding door is flush with the wall of the house, can be understood in one of two ways. I understood originally that the sliding door, the way most of these sliding doors work, there are two panes of glass within doors, and you open one half and you slide the door into a groove which is right behind the other half. If that's the case, so there are two different possibilities. And the more common case that I've seen in such a circumstance is for me going from the outside into the inside, what happens usually is that as you're walking in, the right side of that area is completely closed by the glass door, completely closed, sliding glass door. It doesn't move. That doesn't slide. The half that slides in most cases is the left half as you're going from outside to inside, that slides behind the right half. If that is the case we're discussing, it seems to me the custom of Ashlishi is to place the mezuzah on the post of the stationary half of the sliding door combination, the part that does not slide, although in theory it could slide, but usually it's limited in such a way, it's not considered to be a movable door. It's really considered to be, from a perspective of halacha, part of the wall. It's part of the wall. And if it's part of the wall, we then say that the mezuzah should be placed on the post itself, which is the going to be the halfway point of that whole sliding door facility. It's one big contraption, two parts. You put the mezuzah in the middle, because that, in effect, is considered to be the wall. This seems to be the case that's being discussed in this question. If, on the other hand, it slides the other way, then the place to put it is on the right-hand side as you're going from outside to inside. If that's the case, then the questioner means, well, if you put it at that spot, the door was going to bang into it. Maybe there's no other room on the right-hand post to place it, where it's not going to be crushed by the sliding door coming across. If that's the case, then it's a serious question what to do. It'll be better to put it on the outside than the inside. But even better than that, probably going to be enough room to put the mezuzah straight up, upright, on the outside of where the sliding door would come in. According to most authorities, that would be an acceptable way to place the mezuzah. Thank you very much.
Rebbe, thank you, and we hope, Bezrat Hashem, we can call upon you again in the future.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.